I would also like to welcome the members, our key stakeholders, and all guests who are here this morning to just to also receive this briefing that will be coming from the World Bank. And a special word of welcome to the World Bank officials. Indeed, as this broader committee, we are looking forward to learning from you. And we really appreciate your timing, because we're looking at this information as information that will assist us, you know, to understand also the national annual budget that will be tabled, and particularly your macroeconomic aspect of it, because we have to have deeper insights if we are to make a quality input also as this committee. So we are looking forward from learning from you. But what will happen is members will listen carefully to the presentation, and thereafter they will be given an opportunity to usefully and meaningfully engage with your presentation. Thank you very much. Whilst Mrs. Coleman is coming to the front, we will then take the apologies. Are there any apologies?
Good morning, Chairperson, honorable members and guests. We've received two apologies from the Standing Committee on Appropriations. They are Ms. Natasha Lone Tlangwini, and the second one is from Mr. Manzoor Seikimam. We've also received an apology from the Portfolio Committee on Economic Development of S. Jane Komo. Thank you.
Are there any reasons provided by the members of the Appropriations Committee?
Ms. Low indicated that she's not feeling well and she'll be going to the doctor.
Okay.
Mr. Seikimam didn't provide reason.
All right. Yesterday when I met him, he did say he's double booked, but I really begged him to come. I'm sure he will join us a little late. Okay, thank you so much for all the apologies. Honorable members, do you accept the apologies? So you, yes, please speak up so that we can all hear.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. I propose that we need to accept the apologies.
Please use the mic so that we can hear. Sorry.
The apologies are accepted.
Thank you very much. So the apologies are accepted. All right, maybe also table the apologies from the Social and Economic Development. Economic Development, yes. Portfolio Committee.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chairperson, Mrs. Posa. Good morning, colleagues. From Economic Development, we're very happy to be part of this meeting. I think we're meeting for the first time with the committee. And we just had our management meeting now in the morning. We're from our management meeting. Unfortunately, we have some of our members who are double booked also, who belong to other committees. But I'm here with the member of the management committee, Mr. Kriani, and the staff. We have our researcher. We also have PLO from the Minister and the Deputy Minister. We also have the PLOs from the Minister and the Deputy Minister. So we have that team here with us. Our Secretary will also join us. Thanks a lot.
Well, thank you so much. What's key is that you are here and we will be able to share this information for our work in our different committees. We will then move on to item number 3, which is presentation by the World Bank. And maybe if you could introduce yourself again so that everybody can know who, you know, is talking to us. We take you very seriously and we are looking forward to learning from you. Over to you, sir.
Thank you very much, Mrs. Chairperson. Good morning, everybody, honorables, ladies and gentlemen. We are extremely pleased and honored to be here to engage and exchange on the findings of our most recent report. My name is Sébastien Dessus. I'm a program leader at the World Bank based in Pretoria and covering South Africa and neighboring countries and covering in particular programs related to macroeconomic issues, governance, poverty, private and financial sector development. And my colleague Zandil is here with me also. She is in charge of the communication for our office. We are extremely pleased to be here to present and engage with you on this report. I think we all learn from each other through these debates. The World Bank, as you know, is a financial institution that extends credit and loans and grants to countries, governments in particular, but it's also a platform to exchange views on the policies, options, solutions to eradicate poverty and reduce inequality based on evidence. And we are trying to work on the evidence we can gather in the countries in which we operate as well as in other countries, because we are actually present in more than almost 200 countries in the world. So I think it's a great place to exchange point of views to try to find the solutions, pragmatic solutions. This is the ninth edition of a report that we call the South Africa Economic Update, and I understand my predecessors were also there to discuss with you these reports, so I'm very happy to continue this practice of engaging with the Parliament and the Budget Office in particular. These reports typically have two parts. One deals with the recent macroeconomic developments and outlook, and there is always a second part, or the second section, which is more focused on a policy issue of relevance to the reduction of the poverty and inequalities, and very often deals with fiscal issues, because it's the main instrument of economic policy. There are four main messages in this report. I don't know to sit that maybe I would like to discuss up front so that we see where we're going in this discussion. First one related to the macroeconomic overall environment and outlook for South Africa. And what the message is that we see a modest recovery, but also a very fragile recovery from the very low growth of 2016, 15, and 14, where we had negative per capita income growth. We see a modest recovery in 2017 and 18, but this recovery will be extremely fragile and subject to a number of downside risks unless private investment really takes off. When it comes to some of the options that could be considered to foster private investment, we're looking in this report at the tax incentives that are provided to investors in the different sectors. And what we suggest, based on our findings, is that reorienting investment tax incentives to the sectors of agriculture, manufacturing, construction, and trade would actually encourage more private investment and foster job creation. The third message is that following the depreciation of the rand, protracted depreciation of the rand since 2008-09, and the decline, the drop in commodity prices from the top in 2012, we see that the investment opportunities have shifted from one sector to another, and that investment opportunities for investors in South Africa now lie mostly in those sectors that I just mentioned before, which are agriculture, manufacturing, construction, and trade. And realigning tax incentives toward those sectors would have a greater impact
given the new investment opportunities in those sectors and will amplify growth and job creation. And the last message is that these tax incentives have also an important role to play to foster job creation at zero fiscal cost. It's important to think of solutions, options to improve the quality of your budget while taking into account the constraints in which the country operates today and the tightness of the budget situation and the budget constraints overall. So finding solution to reallocate public funds across program is certainly something we'd like to encourage. Well, as you know, the growth has been decelerating in South Africa in the last years. It is mostly due to the end of what we call the commodity super cycle, which is reflected in the decline in commodity prices. This is not uncommon. This is not South Africa is not the only country which suffers from those price declines. Actually, if you look at the situation of commodity exporters in 2016 and their growth is almost the same as that of South Africa in 2016. But what we've seen is that commodity prices have a very strong impact on overall GDP growth in South Africa. And according to our estimates, since 2012, almost 4 percentage points of GDP growth have been lost in South Africa due to the decline in commodity prices. In other words, had the prices stayed at the level of 2012, growth would have been almost double what it has been between 2012 and 16. So it's a huge reliance. South Africa is extremely reliant on commodity prices. And because population grow faster than the economy, incomes per capita have been declining for 3 years, and therefore poverty has probably increased. When you look at the sectors that have been driving growth in the recent years, you see that it is mostly the financial sector and services which have been driving growth. Agriculture has been extremely volatile due to the lack of rains in 15-16 and it's now slightly rebounding, but it's still very volatile. On the other hand, the sectors which employ a lot of people, such as manufacturing and mining have been growing extremely slowly in these recent years. Now, if you take a longer perspective and you start looking at job creation, which I think is a concern for everybody in this room, and the center of our attention is actually in this report, where we call it private investment for jobs, you see that since 1993, almost all the jobs that have been created in South Africa have been created in services. In contrast, agriculture has shed a lot of jobs, mining has shed a lot of jobs, and manufacturing has shed a lot of jobs. And as you will see later on, we pay particular attention to the manufacturing sector because it is a sector that typically has a lot of what we call multiplier effect. When you create one job, or you create value addition in this sector, there you create a lot of job indirectly in other sectors. It is good for your exports and your balance of payments, and it is good as well for job creation. So the jobs have been only created in services, and it is a bit it's a bit worrisome because you want to see a vibrant manufacturing sector given all the externalities it provides for the rest of the economy in terms of job creation, export receipts, etc., and productivity gains very often. But we've seen that the share of manufacturing in GDP and the share of capital stock, cumulated investment of manufacturing in total capital stock, has been declining since 1993. Now, as we all know, the quality of growth or the pace of economic growth in South Africa these days is largely insufficient to create the number of jobs that the society needs to reduce unemployment and reduce poverty and inequality. If we take the target of the NDP, which is a target that we take very seriously, of reducing unemployment to about 6% by 2030, this means that from 2012, 600,000 jobs need to be created every year. But on average, since 2012, and in previous year as well, South Africa has only been able to create about 250,000 jobs. So almost only half of what is needed to reduce the unemployment rate. And as a consequence, given population growth and the number of youth entering the labor market, the unemployment rate stays very high, and then particularly for unskilled and semi-skilled workers and new entrants on the market, women and young people. And what we can see too is if you look at in retrospect in 1993 is that most of the jobs have been created during what we call the commodity super cycle, during the mining boom, but it has been clearly insufficient to reduce unemployment. What we see also, if you look at the demand side of growth, I mean, looking at what is pulling growth from the demand, it private consumption, public consumption, investment, exports, etc., we see that investment has been extremely weak in this last quarter, almost throughout all 2016 and a big part of 15. And again, it's extremely worrisome because it means that over time, the productive capacity of the economy is not growing, or is not growing very fast. And so, if the productive capacity of the economy is not growing, it means that the potential for higher GDP growth is declining. What we see too is two things, and I will come back to all these points later on when we discuss the focus on the policies in this report is two things which are very important also to keep in mind when looking at the South African economy. First is the protracted and let's say structural decline in the rand since 2011. The national currency has been depreciated by almost 50% in the last 5 years. And it's completely changing the landscape of South Africa vis-à-vis the rest of the world, especially in terms of competitiveness vis-à-vis the imports and on export markets as well. So that's something important to keep in mind with its pros and cons, but it's a very, very, very important factor that affect the South African economy. But the second factor, which is also very important, is the volatility of the rand. You have this long-term trend of depreciation of the rand, but also very high daily volatility. And while the first factor, the long-term decline in the rand, may have some positive impacts, let's say, for instance, on export competitiveness, the second one, which is with short-term volatility, is perceived by investors, when we ask them through surveys, as extremely negative for them because they don't know on what base to make their economic calculations and computations, and so they are telling us that volatility is a problem for them. What we've seen too in these recent years, and maybe as a result of what we said just before, or maybe for other reasons too, is that South African investors invest more abroad than foreign investors invest in South Africa. And that's also a problem because you have a lot of financial resources in the country which are actually being exported abroad to develop projects abroad and not in South Africa, meaning less jobs in South Africa. You see it both on the foreign direct investment side, which is the investment in new projects, I mean economic projects, or in the portfolio investment, which is more like buying shares at the GSE. But the first one, FDI, is particularly worrisome because this is really where you want to see more investment in South Africa from South African investors first, because that's the base of your economy, but also from foreign investors that can bring new ideas, new technologies, and the like. So the net position of South Africa is negative, and this has to be reversed. It also means there is a lot of potential to attract more investment if the conditions are better in South Africa for investors, if they are perceived by investors as better. Now, when we are making our projections, we see a slight rebound in GDP growth in 2017 and 18. Our current projections and estimates also for 2016 suggest that GDP growth could rebound from a very low 0.4% in 2016 to 1.1% in 17 and 1.8% in 18. So these are projection estimates. They have an interval of a confidence error. So maybe you can think that next year it's going to be around 1, or this year it's going to be around 1, and next year it's going to be around 2. They are subject to a number of uncertainties, shocks, etc. But they remain extremely low, and only by 2018 we would see growth outpacing economic growth outpacing GDP growth. So even in 2017, GDP growth per capita will stay negative. And what we are saying, looking at the different things, is that really the key to accelerate growth is really private investment. That's the only leverage to really increase growth, because private consumption as of today is I would say is very much constrained by the debt of the households, the level of unemployment of the households is not going to change overnight. Public consumption and investment is also constrained by lack of fiscal resources, and we've all heard about the risk of a downgrade, which is a serious risk. I mean, it exists and would affect even much more GDP growth. Actually, we've made the calculation that a downgrade to below investment level for sovereign would result in at least 1 percentage point of GDP loss compared with the current situation, assuming that the situation is resolved quickly afterwards. So it could be extremely costly, and what it means is that it really constrains, in our opinion, the authorities to use the fiscus as a way to stimulate the economy, and that solutions need to be found really within the existing envelope of fiscal resources. So we've made the calculation that the downgrade would cost about 1,000 rand per capita to each South African, and would push more than 150,000 people below the poverty line. So it could be extremely costly, and it has to be taken seriously. Unfortunately, in 2016, this risk has been averted, but the threat is still there. And unless these rating agencies are convinced that the South Africa is becoming more solvent, will be better able to pay its debt, this threat will still occur. And the only way to convince rating agencies for what they are, that the situation will improve, is to really work on the private investment side. That shows that the potential of the economy to increase, to accelerate growth will improve over time. And that's extremely important, and I think this is what rating agencies are looking for. What we are saying too is that despite the fact that there is now a small rebound in commodity prices that we start to observe in 2017, this is good news for South Africa and for the miners, but it is not the strategy on which the country can rely exclusively, far from it, because not only there's still great uncertainty on the rebound in commodity prices, Second, we've seen that despite the fact that those commodity prices were extremely high, like 5 years ago, they have not created many jobs in the economy. And third, that many other countries will do better for some reasons. And so the competition will be fierce on the commodity markets. Now, the second part of the report tries to explore the one option to try to foster private investment. And this is we're discussing some elements of South African industrial policy, and I'll go into it just now. But of course, this is not the only way to encourage private investment. There are many others, and the government has been actively working on many of them. And I'm mentioning a few which we think are important. The first one, as you all know, is the infrastructure bottlenecks. There's been a lot of progress, for instance, on the electricity front in 2016. But this is something which has constrained private investment for a number of years, and work needs to continue on that front to make sure that electricity is available, but it's also extend to transport, the ports, etc. So it's a, there's a big agenda here, but I'm not going to discuss it here today. Second, and maybe, I mean, in my humble opinion, the most important and definitive challenge for South Africa is the education front, and improve education and skills of workers so that they can grow, they can prosper, they can be employed, and they can prosper. This is still the education level, although slightly improving, are still extremely low in primary, secondary education, and then it reflects on the tertiary education and its problems. We have a skill shortage, as we call it, and it is extremely harmful for the society and for the economy. A third dimension is labor relations, and I see that also a lot of progress has been made in the dialogue between the private sector, the government, and the unions, and it needs to be continued to reduce tension and find solutions that are not harmful to the economy and to the workers. A fourth domain is the competition and regulations. There's a lot to be done there also here, and it has been mentioned in previous speeches from officials. There's still a lot of concentration in economic activities, and here I'm not talking about a group of people, but I'm talking of concentration, market powers in some sectors, monopolies, oligopolies, etc., that exert a very high cost on the South African economy and has a very large impact also on job creation. I'm not going to discuss too much this, but we can discuss it a bit if you like. Last one is a loose concept which is used by many observers and discussions of the economic life of South Africa, is what people call policy uncertainty. It remains to me also something I'm not sure to fully capture, but when you hear investors, they remain uncertain on the policy direction that the country is taking, and it has to do with both the substance of the laws and regulations that are being put in the pipeline for discussion at the parliament. So what will be the rules in the future, but also the process of it, the back and forth in terms of making a decision, coming back to the cabinet, going back to the parliament, etc. This is something we are trying to explore and put some granularity to it to really try to understand what it really means and how things could be improved to give more transparency, more certainty on what the policy decision will be. And of course, I mean, you are the center of, I think, of those discussions, because it's your mandate. Now, so we're going to discuss now what we call industrial policy in South Africa, which we understand as being a recognition from the authorities that there is some value encourage the investment and the allocation of factors of production in some strategic sectors. It makes more sense for the economy to invest in some sectors than in others, given the what we call the externalities, the benefits for the society it provides. And these benefits cannot be captured or internalized directly by private investors, because private investments only care about their profit, but encouraging some investment in some sectors has benefit for the societies that go beyond the benefit of the investors or the people who get a job in the sectors. This is what we call externalities, and we'll come back to it. So there's this notion that investing in some sectors is good for is good for the economy, and we'd like to encourage private investment in those sectors in particular. Okay? So that's and we are going to explore some of the aspects of it, and there are many of them, and I'll come back to it, but we're going to explore in particular the advantages given in terms of tax to invest in some specific sectors. Overall, what we've seen since 1993 is that the economy has become more capital intensive. The number of machines per worker has increased. This is not uncommon. It happens everywhere. It increased the productivity of workers, so it should increase their salaries as well. It makes the economy more competitive, but also, of course, it is shedding jobs in some sectors when machines are replacing jobs. So there are some pictures that there used to be one machine per worker in 94, and now we have five machines for three workers in 2015. What we see too is that I'll give you a lot of facts, but I think you will understand how they get together in the end, is that the capital has gone mostly into the sectors which were the less capital incentives in the first place, which are services. Now, if you look at the tax incentives, it's important to look at the landscape in which those tax incentives evolve, and the pace at which capital is being moved from one sector to another. Because if you want to encourage that movement, you want to make sure that capital can move from one sector to another, that is not completely fixed into a sector. Otherwise, the tax incentive would have no impact if capital was to stay forever in the same sectors with the shares constant. And what you see is that in the recent period, I'm not going to what we call period three, there's been a lot of investment and a lot of relocation of capital across sectors. So you say maybe it's a good thing that capital can move easily from one sector to another to try to in search of economic opportunities at the greatest returns in terms of additional production and therefore also job creation, and maybe go into those sectors where the economy is most competitive and can gain new markets, etc. So that's a good signal. But the very, very bad signal is that in these recent years too, actually, as is a maybe complicated calculations, but the capital through new investment has shifted to the sectors where the return on capital is the lowest. So you want capital to grow, to be invested in, or you want investment to grow in those sectors where it can generate the largest returns in terms of additional value addition, profits, wages, etc. But what we see is actually exactly the opposite. And it has costed, at the macroeconomic level, it has costed at least 1% of GDP, what we call losses of allocation or negative gains of allocation across sectors. They have been positive up to 2008-09, and they started really to slow down in 2008, and they've turned negative from 2012 to 2016, and it's extremely worrisome. And this reflects in particular the disengagement of investors from the manufacturing sector. Now, if you look at the first thing we do in this report is you look at all the fiscal system encourage or discourage investor to invest in one sector versus another sector. Your tax code is full of provision that are sector specifics. For instance, in the mining sector, you can depreciate in the first year all your investment of the same year. You have corporate income taxes which differ also across sectors. Now, so we are making the calculation of what is the return an investment will make on his last rand invested, which we call the marginal effective tax rate. You say you have the choice, you are an investor, you have the choice to invest in the manufacturing sector or the mining sector, for instance. Okay, and you see what is the impact of your tax code on the returns that the investor will make after tax are being paid. Okay, the tax on the manufacturing sector means that in order for the investor to get a post-tax rate of return of 10%, he needs to find an investment project that generates a rate of return before tax of almost 30%, because the marginal effective tax rate is almost 20%. 30 minus 20 is 10. In the mining sector, the marginal effective tax rate is almost zero. So he can get he will need to find a project that can generate a tax rate of almost 9-10% before taxes. It's the same. Let's put it differently. It's the same for an investor in terms of rate of return after tax rate to invest in a project that generates 30% rate of return in the manufacturing sector, or 10% in the mining sector. And it's, of course, much more difficult to find a project that generates 30% in the manufacturing sector than in the mining sector. Yeah? So this has, we believe that it may have quite an impact on the allocation of capital across sectors, and this may also have an impact, it may have had an impact on what the allocation of capital across sector that we've seen in the last years, which has been negative, which has probably kept a lot of investment in some sectors where rate of returns were much lower. So that's an element of the South African industrial policy. So here I'm only talking about it. The calculation were made in 2012, so this is before what we call the introduction of the DTI incentives. We're talking here of general allowances for capital depreciation and corporate income tax rates, mostly. Now, the second thing we've been looking at, based on this first calculation, is what has been the impact of tax incentive in terms of encouraging additional investment or not. And actually, we've relied a lot on the report that was published by the Budget Office of the Parliament on the same tax incentives. And I think this is the same concern, that what you want to see is incentive that works, that generates, that really encourage additional investment, and have just been put in the pocket of investors, will not change their investment decision based on these incentives. Okay. So, in order to try to assess the impact of tax incentives on additional investment, we've been looking at the tax files that have been collected by SARS for the period 2006-12 for all the firms that are paying taxes. Of course, they are anonymous and everything is respected, but it's an incredible data set that allows you to really look at the response of individual firms to a change in tax incentive and what it means for their investment. Have they invested more in response to a change in tax incentive or not? Okay? And what we see is that in some sectors, you see a systematic response and positive response to tax incentives. when you provide a tax incentive, investors react with higher investment. This is the purpose of the incentive. So it's good. But in some other sectors, there is no response. Or the response is so dispersed and different across firms that you cannot say statistically, yes, I see systematically a response in this sector to a change in tax incentives. So based on that, we've made the calculation of what has been the impact of tax incentive on additional investment in each sector and on job creation. Okay? In some sectors, and then you see it, but you have much more detailed tables in the report. So we see that in agriculture, in manufacturing, in construction, in trade, and in services, and in SMEs too, but to a much lower extent, there's been a positive response to tax incentives. Investors really react to these incentives, okay? And they tend to replace, at the margin, jobs with capital, because it's an investment tax incentive, it's not an employment tax incentive, but still, in the process, they create also more jobs. The proportion of capital of jobs increase in favor of capital, but still, it creates some jobs. And you see the difference across the different sectors. But in some sectors, you don't see any response to tax incentives. So it maybe means that those sectors are making extremely long-term investment decisions, that they might be constrained by other factors. It may be, for instance, infrastructure for one sector. It may be policy certainty for another one. We've seen that, for instance, electricity sector, we don't see really a response of tax incentives in terms of additional investment, but we know from other sources that IPPs have been very responsive to the fact that some market was secured for them for a number of years. So if they were to invest in electricity, they know they can sell their electricity for many years. But in some sector, it does not pay off. And then so you can make the calculation and say some incentives are useful, some are not. And if you were just to eliminate those that are not useful, and you make incentives overall much more efficient because you concentrate those incentives in sectors where there is a response. And the savings that are being made can be used for many other things. I don't know what they can, then it's another debate. They can be used for education, they can be used for infrastructure, they can be used for employment incentives, they can be used to reduce taxes, I don't know. But what we know is that some taxes, some incentives are working, some are not working. Now, maybe it's a coincidence, but the sectors in which the incentives are working are the sectors that create the largest number of jobs, directly and indirectly. It's called, we call the labor intensity. One million rand of value added generates a number of jobs. And agriculture, trade, services, construction, and manufacturing are the largest provider of jobs, creator of jobs. If you encourage activity in these sectors, these are the sectors we are creating the largest number of jobs directly and indirectly. And it's very important to think of it of direct-indirect decomposition, because you provide an incentive to a sector and you will say, oh, it means that they've created one more job, so the fiscal cost of creating one more job is actually quite high, maybe quite high. But when you look, when you compute all the jobs that have been created down the line, because a firm will require additional input from other sectors or other firms, which will themselves demand a larger number of jobs, then it reduces very much the fiscal cost of creating a job through tax incentive, in particular in the manufacturing sector, where in the end of the day, for each job created directly in a firm, you create almost five jobs outside. So the cost of creating a job through fiscal incentives would be reduced by five. That's extremely important. And so we are saying some sectors are more responsive to tax incentives. These sectors are the ones that are creating the largest number of jobs. And third, because of the depreciation of the rand and the decline in commodity price, these are also, to a great extent, the sectors where now you have the the largest new investment opportunities, where new investment opportunities are emerging because of the competitiveness that you gain through depreciated rand, etc. So we're making calculation also to see what are those investment opportunities. So it makes sense in our opinion to continue these tax incentives in the sector that work, the more so because the opportunities for investment in these sectors are today larger. So there's potential to invest. It's good to encourage investors in those sectors. And these are, by the way, the sectors that create the largest number of jobs. So that's quite important. And lastly, and this is also a discussion we have in the report, we have a few other also small discussion. We've been looking at the impact of job creation on poverty reduction. And here the results are a bit mixed, and I would say not so great. We're using a statistical techniques to see, look on the one hand at the pool of unemployed people, and on the other hand the characteristics of being employed in a given sector. And we're saying, now if you were to employ one person more in the agricultural sector, who would be the one in the pool of unemployed would be the one that would qualify for being employed in that sector. And then we look at its characteristics, its poverty characteristics, the fact that he receives grants and the like, and we see suddenly getting this job will change his situation at the family level. And what we see is that the impact on poverty reduction is there, but it's not so large. One job basically reduced by lift out of poverty one person. You could think of 3 or 4 persons because you say one person will support a full family. But the fact of the matter is that a number of people who are unemployed are not poor, okay, and that wages too are extremely low. So creating a job is unfortunately not the only solution to reduce poverty and inequality. The quality of jobs is also extremely important. This is why capital needs to accompany jobs. You need to invest in the environment in which worker operates. Education is one, of course, but equipment, etc., to make workers much more productive and reap the benefits of this higher productivity to increase their wages is extremely important. So that's why also good industrial policy matters, because we expect it to raise the wages of the workers. And with that, I would like to conclude and thank you very much for your attention. Thank you.
Thank you so much for the insightful presentation. Honorable members, I observe that you really listened attentively. But I'm now going to invite the honorable members to interrogate the presentation. As you do so, shall we try and be short and to the point? Over to you. Waiting. Thank you very much, Honorable Member Dr. Fick.
Thank you, Honorable Chairperson. Thanks to the World Bank for an insightful presentation. It's given us a lot to ponder about. Just a few questions that I have with regards to the presentation. Firstly, if we go to slide number 2, page number 2, the bottom slide there. You mentioned about the reason why GDP per capita growth has been slowing is because of the commodity prices that have declined. Can we just get an indication, if it's available, why has that happened? And if it's because of the oversupply, could it not be then that the supply could be controlled, like they do in some instances with the crude oil? in order to push the prices up. Then on slide, page number 4, we you've indicated that the GDP is much lower than the targeted, as targeted in our NDP. Now, we're already 3 years into the NDP, and clearly it's not working. So we've got a number of decisions that we have to make because it's dependent on this NDP and these growth rates here. Now we're sitting on next year in 2018 only at 1.8. My question is, when would you forecast that we had reached that 5.4% as envisaged in the NDP? And if you were making the decision, would we have to adjust the targets as outlined in the NDP? On slide number, page number 6, which the second slide, you talk about the investment, the rating downgrade. Now, this is a sensitive one, and for the reasons that I'm going to give. You say the consequences of a downgrade. Now, our government seems to have a solution in another rating agency, which is the BRICS agency. Now, some people seem to believe that might work. We know that the other ratings agencies, that's S&P, Fitch, and Moody's, are the ones that investors might look to. But would investors then also consider the BRICS ratings agency? Because as South Africans, we seem to think that that would be the solution, is by getting, in order to get a better rating, we will ignore, as much as the investors wouldn't, the ratings agency. And then, lastly, on page number 8, just a question for clarification. I noticed that you have given different periods there and indicated high capital reallocation and low capital reallocation. Can I just get a reason why you've not given 3 equal periods? Because I've noticed one is 8, 5, and 6. Oh, well, one is 8 and 5. Because it's easy then, in my view, to manipulate the information you want by putting them into the periods that you would like to. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your questions. I will allow you to respond to this as members are still working out more questions. But also, maybe after your response, I would like Professor Mohammed to also comment. And then, thanks. All right. Yes, over to you, sir.
Thank you, Mrs. Chairperson. Thank you, sir. So I'll try to address your questions. They are not easy, but I'll say what I can on them. On the supply of commodities and the introduction of a cartel, that would obviously serve the purpose of controlling the prices and probably reduce commodities. Now, I would say two things. One, it's an element of collusion among countries, and it's something you don't want to see in your country, maybe you don't want to see at the international level, and it's also harmful for the other countries. Second, I'm not sure it is feasible as for oil, for instance, because I think there's much more dispersion of producers in terms of commodities across the world, and so many commodities, and there are a lot of co-movements. Also, people anticipating that if the price of one commodity falls, the other one will fall, etc. People are arbitrating all the time, so that's a second consideration. But the third one, which I think is the most important, is that what we've seen in most countries is that excessive reliance on commodities is negative for job creation. Those sector value beneficiation is a good thing to do, but it takes a long time. You're still at the mercy of very high volatility that you might try to reduce through controlling the supply. It's going to be difficult. The multiplier effects are extremely small, as we've seen in the mining sector. They don't generate too much jobs. you can, almost by default, have a lot of concentration in those sectors in the economy, which are also unfully, and then it all goes into the, and you create a lot of rents in the systems that might have negative impact in terms of job creation, in terms of governance. I'm very new to South Africa, but I've been working in a number of other countries which were reliant on commodities, and I was actually surprised by the extent of the commodity reliance still in South Africa. And I don't think that will be a sufficient strategy at relying on commodities to create the number of jobs and reduce the inequalities you want to reduce. That's to me, the focus should be put elsewhere. Of course, you don't want to destroy the sector, etc. But you cannot rely only on this sector. And we've seen that a lot of the incentives that are being given to the sectors do not work. So I'll be a bit cautious there. On the NDP targets, etc. Yes, they are probably too ambitious, and they probably need to be revised. But I think that there's still a lot of value in this exercise of long-term planning. It's also based on international experience. Those long-term plans are almost by definition always too optimistic, because you want to show an aspiration, a vision, to create a vision for your country and bring people together and build some consensus on what is important for the country. The objectives of the NDP are extremely relevant. These are actually the one also of the World Bank. We've taken yours. I mean, eradicating poverty, reducing inequalities, these are the aspirations for your country. So this is already in itself, I think, something already achieved, to say what are the most important goals we want to achieve in our society. And then you can discuss the GDP at 5.4, 3.2, whatever. But because you want to bring in everybody, and you want to make it very consultative, you tend to be too optimistic, and you make optimistic assumptions to be able to finance your aspirations. So yes, it has to be revised, but it's still a process that needs to be pursued, to be refined, to be revisited based on evidence, to look for what works, what doesn't work. What can be done in the next 13 years to advance as much as possible towards the goals that you set for yourself. And the World Bank is actually currently working with the National Planning Commission to try to evaluate what has been working, what has not been working, and or to be maybe also a bit more selective in what the country can do, given lower resources than anticipated, to still go as far as possible in terms of achieving the goals you set for yourself. On rating agencies, everybody hates the rating agencies. It's not South Africa specific. Nobody wants to be told by a private agency in the world what will be the future of your country, etc. They are not elected. These are the agencies. Okay, so nobody likes them. They are there, and for some reason they are able to convince the investors. So if your BRICS agency is doing a better job because you think the agencies are not doing a great job, and there are a lot of literature also to show they are not necessarily doing a great job, they are more followers than anticipating market movements, this is fine. In the end of the day, this should not be a goal in itself to convince the agency. The goal is to accelerate growth and create jobs, etc. Maybe a BRICS agency will do it. It all depends on its credibility and its knowledge, its deep knowledge of the BRICS economy. But maybe it's better positioned to influence investors because but it has to be demonstrated. And I don't know. Last on the periods, we didn't decide. I mean, if you look at the blue and orange bars. We're just trying to understand what happens. So to me, but we can discuss that. I see if you compare the blue and the orange, I see a first period, and we can put the limit where you want, where the orange bars are quite low, and then suddenly you see an acceleration. I would put it around 2002, 2003, 2004, yeah, and then it stops in 2008, and then it's more stable afterwards. Okay, that's one look at the orange. And for the blue, I see basically two periods. The first period that goes from 94 to also 2006-07, and then suddenly it accelerates after that. Okay, so when you combine the two periods, and we've decided for three periods, but it's not, it's just based on how we visualize this thing. It is not very important. The message here is that there's quite a turnover in terms of capital across sectors, and it has not, my initial intuition was that the effectiveness of industrial policy should have been affected by lower rate of investments in the country, lower economic growth, and because there's lower economic growth, there is also lower turnover, because it's more difficult to reallocate capital in period of slow growth than in period of high growth. If you have a tractor, this is your investment, your capital in a sector, and you want now suddenly to shift it to the service sector and to turn it into a computer, it's not easy. It's much easier to buy a new computer from scratch, fresh money, with new investment in period of high growth to facilitate reallocation of capital across sectors. So my initial intuition was that industrial policy was not very effective in period of slow growth. But in reality, when you look at the turnover of capital across sectors, it has been very high in those recent years. So it's against my intuition, and I think it's what we call evidence-based also sometimes. You have to look at the facts, and we can discuss the methodology and stuff, but there's no prejudgment on the periods or anything like that. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your response. I will now request Prof to comment, and I see there's a hand, Honorable Member Snugwanyana, and Honorable Member Tliane, I'm sorry, and then Honorable Member Gwabaza, in that order. Over to you.
Honorable Chair, thank you very much for this opportunity to respond. And first, I do want to congratulate the World Bank and for the good work. And also, I mean, over time, a shift in direction where issues like industrial policy, thinking about allocation of capital across sectors, social returns to capital have become more important. And I think we're seeing the impact of people like Joseph Stiglitz, Justin Lin, and others, and also not only at the top, but within the World Bank to change it. So I think this is a very valuable report for South Africa, especially now helping us to think through how we address our problems, especially with unemployment. The first point I wanted to make, and that was linked to the allocation of capital. In my own work, which draws on heterodox economics arguments that there's been financialization and applying that to the South African economy, what we saw in that period, I don't want to put that graph back on with the changes in allocation. If you look at the period from after 2002-2003, there's an inflow of short-term capital, foreign capital, into the South African economy, especially portfolio flows into the stock exchange. Now, that drove a certain kind of investment and reallocation of capital. Unfortunately, it drove a reallocation away from productive manufacturing types of investments towards finance. During that period, if you look at that period 2003 to 2008, we saw a 22% increase in credit granted to the private sector. If you look at, I mean, the growth in capital there, you're looking at 4 to 5%. So what happens to the others? That's a big question for the South African economy. Why aren't we getting fixed investment when we've seen such a huge increase in debt? And that debt coming because we've actually gotten large amounts of short-term inflows into the economy. Now, the question there then is that we saw growth during that period being driven by debt-driven consumption and speculation in financial markets and real estate markets. And so I think the question for me is when we think about tax incentives, I agree very much with mining that we've the actual tax rates in mining are close to zero, and in manufacturing it's 20% or over. We need to also think about that in terms of wholesale and retailing and in finance. The one comment I do want to make on your work and your data is that when it comes to employment especially, it's really important to disaggregate, to separate out finance and business services, or finance, insurance, and real estate and business services. If you look at the employment growth during a lot of the period you show, the jobs are in business services, and many of those jobs are linked to this reallocation of capital away from productive towards and also linked to what we call the growth in labor broking. So when South African companies move, when labor brokers go and say we're going to provide cleaning services, South African manufacturing firms, mining firms, the universities, the banks will outsource cleaners. We see in the universities now a big fight to reinsource the cleaning services. Those jobs then get measured in business services. When you show it with finance, everybody looks at it, the first word they see is finance, and they say, ooh, finance is contributing more to GDP, and we're seeing employment growth in finance. So I think it's really important for clarity to separate out business services. And the jobs in business services have been more precarious, lower paying, and have added to inequality and poverty. And so we're seeing this shift. So the one thing is financialization linked to the growth of finance, but also linked to the inflows of short-term capital and the volatility of that, which is very much linked to the exchange rate volatility you spoke about, for me is a really important factor in understanding why we're not getting manufacturing and productive services investment and a shift and a reallocation of capital towards other sectors, especially finance and real estate. Just on real estate, you know, during that period of growth, we saw a huge increase, the biggest increase in the world in the real estate prices in South Africa. So basically bubbles being driven by foreign capital inflows. So this also brings me to the comments about the ratings. And there's a, you draw on the paper, this one by Anush Hassan, Augu, and Subia. And I worry that because of the number of caveats, I've read this paper carefully, and I mentioned it in the medium before in our pre-medium-term budget policy statement. Is that they admit that the period is too short, the number of experiences of downgrades are too short, and so for me it's really too bold to go and try to say that this will be the impact on South Africa, and that each South African will lose 1,000 rand. I think. I really worry about that. And speaking to people, if you look at the media, in the financial sector, even to people in National Treasury, there's a sense that a lot of that may already have been taken into account within the markets. The second point, which I also mentioned in the pre-medium-term budget policy statement, is that National Treasury made the same observation that the IMF, that the World Bank made, that you know, that there's a link between that and capital flight. And my point was that if we really want to study the experience of capital flight in South Africa, we must link that to periods of surges of short-term inflows of capital and then what happens after that. And so if we look at the experience 97, 2001 of the financial crisis, I mean, those happened and the impact on the economy, like the million jobs lost after during the period during the global financial crisis, was because of short-term outflows, big outflows from the South African economy. Then we need to look at regulations that deal with capital flight and short-term capital movements rather than be that concerned with credit ratings. I'm not underplaying the role that credit ratings plays and that we shouldn't try and maintain our current credit rating, but to use that as an argument about how far we constrain our fiscal policy is something I think we need to engage on much more and be more careful about in the discussion. I wanted to say that on the credit ratings, I think the the development of the new development bank with the BRICS and the BRICS moving towards the credit ratings agencies, one for me, and this is in answer to Honorable Fick's question, is that it provides alternatives. And it provides, we see the role of BRICS and BRICS finance playing, is that it's got more sympathy and also more experience of developing economies and their needs and pricing according to and in putting in project in terms of their needs. So not saying we're going to look at what S&P and Moody's says versus what the BRICS bank says. It's saying we have got a huge amount of room for competition in the ratings agency business and for alternative views. And that could actually make S&P and Moody's less, what's the word, flagrant about the way they use the threats to downgrade. Maybe I should stop there and give other people a turn, but that's my view. Thanks.
Thank you so much for your input. Honorable Member Snukwanyana?
Thank you very much, Honorable Chair, and thank you very much for the presentation. But maybe let me start with a general comment that maybe confess that I'm not into economics as such. I only understand bits and pieces here and there. But at the same time, I want to also indicate that as I'm sitting here, I'm like a weak student who needs perhaps some individual attention because a lot of it I didn't quite understand. But I do want to just comment, maybe when you started, you mentioned the areas of agriculture, manufacturing and trade and so on as the, you know, the drivers, which can be drivers of our economy. And you went on and mentioned a number of things. And I sit on the Appropriations Committee. I've been trying to fit myself into the whole presentation to say, where exactly do I fit in? Because I think this session is also meant for empowering us to be able to actually engage in our day-to-day work. I'm glad that I've just had an economist actually educating me on quite a number of things, because some of the slides, yes, you spoke to the slides, but I would want, you know, more details, because like I'm saying, my level of understanding is not really up to scratch when it comes to economics. Just to make a few examples, like when you said the weakening rand is discouraging the imports and encouraging exports. And you went on, you said foreign and domestic factors contributed to low foreign investment. Personally, I would have liked to really get a little bit more to be able to understand. There's nothing wrong with this slide, but I think at my level, I definitely need a little bit more. And the other slide that I was trying to make sense out of is this one of addressing domestic constraints that would increase potential GDP growth. I mean, you have all those six elements, which are there. You did a bit of speaking to them, but I didn't quite get it. Like, for instance, if I read something that says reduce policy uncertainty, what does that mean? How do I do that? It's just one of the examples there. Improve education and skills. I am not certain how I would then go about that, but that's why I said from my side, it's just really general comments of about the whole thing. I won't talk about the specifics. Thank you very much, Chair.
Obviously, you have indicated areas where you need clarity. Thank you very much. I'm sure that will be responded to. And then, Honorable Member, I've actually identified people and assert in that order. Honorable Member?
Kliane.
And then Honorable Member Tobas, my right. After that, we can then take Honorable Member, if I'm not making a mistake, Honorable Member Shoppe Sichole. Okay, in that order.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Thank you, Mr. De Souza, for a brilliant presentation. I think one of the thrusts of your presentation is the proposal that South Africa should review or reorientate its investment tax incentive structure, in particular sectors like agriculture, manufacturing, and you suggest that this could possibly improve job creation. Now, Mr. Dissus, our understanding is that the South African incentives bouquet, including the investment tax incentives structure, is already very friendly, very attractive, and has been for quite some time. But one is not very sure if this has already assisted us to see some improvement in job creation. So my question is, given your experience in other developing countries as well, which examples would you give us, Mr. Dissus, who have gone this path, you know, who have done more than we have already done, who have really, you know, reorientated their investment tax incentive structure, who have managed, you know, to experience reasonable job creation in those countries. It's important for us to get these examples so that when we follow some of these proposals that you are making, we should be able to have some kind of reference. On paper, they seem to be very good, but I think we've already walked down that path as South Africa, as far as incentives are concerned, general, including tax in incentives, but it has not been very easy to see the results. If you could assist us with some of those examples, I think that would help us. I thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you, Chairperson. Just on the issue that the last speaker has just raised as well, on the tax on incentives, I do want to understand quite clearly what you are saying there in slide two, that first slide, page two. In other words, you are saying to us the kind of incentives that the country has at the moment is adequate. The important thing for us to do is to reprioritize those incentives in a manner that does not negatively affect the national fiscus. Is that what you're saying? That's the first question. The second question is on page five, the top slide. The unpredictability of the currency. We have a floating currency as opposed to the pegged currency. Now, I'd like to understand what do you suggest should be done in order to arrest this unpredictability, in other words, the volatility, and what have other countries with the floating currency done to try and manage this unpredictability? So if we could have examples thereof. And the last one you made mention of the indebtedness of South African households, which is a real issue, and it's a problem which needs to be addressed quite urgently. The assumption is always that households just borrow for consumption, or put the other way round, they borrow to augment their disposable income. What we have not investigated is what is it that drives the households to be indebted beyond just simple consumption. And I would like us to examine that issue, because I think there is a lot more to it than just and the urge to augment disposable income simply for consumption. And then we always argue that South Africans are not investing. I know that South Africans, a number of South Africans, have short-term and long-term insurance policies. That's investment. I know that South Africans invest in property, but perhaps the question should arise, the uncontrollable or uncontrolled or unregulated property prices may just as well be the issue that needs to be addressed. And of course, the cost of food as well, sometimes driven by petrol prices and recently by drought. But what do we do as well with the cost? Because that also drives consumption. So how do we deal with that question? Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable Member Shopes Tole.
Thank you, Chairperson. And thank you, sorry for coming late. I wasn't late. I have been to every committee room. And ultimately, when I came here, I didn't see you. I saw Comrade Ebusi, and I thought it's something else. And I went back to other. So I've been up and down, and I've missed what I love to hear. But anyway, I do have something for you. I fully agree with PBO on the fact that we need competition, because in economics, competition is good. We need competition in these rating agencies. You know, this is one thing that worries me, and I think today maybe you may assist me. I tried to Google for the reasons why they keep on intimidating us as this country. I try to go to other countries like the UK, maybe France, and the reason that was stated for South Africa, they said it was written, it is because of political instability which will persist until the ANC goes to conference this year and until 2019. That was the reason. In the international arena, that is the reason. So I question, what do they mean by political instability? Then I went to UK. They said stable. With Brexit, is that stability with Brexit? Is there stability in France where there are looming elections coming? There's so much. I was in Germany just now. There is so much uncertainty in France, and there is uncertainty in Germany. There is uncertainty even in Sweden. But why put this uncertainty on us, the developing country? There is certainty here. There is no uncertainty, because the ANC is going to conduct its business properly until we win again in 2019. So remove that uncertainty. The biggest uncertainty is in Brexit.
It was your comment. Thank you so much for all the questions. I'm now going to ask Mr. Desus. Did I pronounce it correctly? Yes. And your partner to respond to the questions. And of course, I take note of the fact that there were also comments. So the comments, it's all right, but just respond to clarity-seeking questions.
Thank you very much, Mrs. Chairperson. Thank you very much to Honorable for all your comments and very insightful and also very difficult and questions sometimes. One of the things we are trying to do in these reports is to focus on something and try to say what we can on based on the evidence that we have and a lot. I will try to comment or try to give some my views on some of the questions you've addressed, but in some cases we just don't have the material to address them, and I wouldn't want to give definitive answers or whatever on a subject that we don't know of, on which we have not worked. Just also something I didn't mention is that this work was done basically commissioned initially by the Davis Tax Commission. That's why we started working on these incentives, etc., because this is something the Davis Tax Committee wanted to investigate a bit more and asked us for if we could work with them on that. And we will actually continue working with them on that subject, try to go more into the details of the different incentives. And now we have also a larger data set, which extend up to 14 or even almost 2015. And those things have to be revisited all the time. It's not like nothing is definitive. I mean, incentives may work at some point, maybe not work in a different context. And so, I would say it's a general call, and we are very happy to participate to this endeavor to keep on exploring, assessing your policies, your instruments, evaluating and monitoring them to see if they are delivering the goals that you have assigned to them. And there are so many fields there that can be explored. Taking the questions and comments in chronological order, from the professor, yes, I very much agree with a lot of things you've said. Financialization, yeah, we mentioned that in the report, we distinguish it from gross fixed investment, and we only look at what has been really investing, or many machines have been bought or upgraded, etc. We don't look at equity, etc., acquisition, and those things. The point about the financials, business service, labor, broking, yes, we also I also agree we could go more into the details. The point was that we tried to stick to, there were two issues. One, when we looked at the data, we tried to group sectors by the type of incentive they were receiving. And then, of course, because the slides are short and you don't have the time for the graphs, you put finance, but it's finance, business service, and I think real estate. It's written in the report, but when you go to the slides, you have to find shortcuts all the time. So forgive me if we give these impressions. But, yes, we really understand the nature of the different services and also the stretch. I mean, those sectors are not uniform at all. You have the finance on the one hand that where you don't create too many jobs, that they're highly paid, and you have business services and security services where you don't get a lot of very low-paid jobs. I agree very much with the concern that has been expressed in this room about the exchange rate volatility, which is linked to the very high degree of financialization of the economy, the openness of the capital account, and the ability for investors to arbitrage between different options on a daily basis, and I think this is a bit harmful to the economy. I don't have an obvious solution. What you see emerging from the literature is that a lot of the volatility in the balance of payments and the capital account of the balance of payments is not only due to goes through the short-term investment, of course, but is very much linked to commodity pricing and anticipation of commodity prices and the impact it will have on the GSE, etc. And so it brings us back to the importance of the mining sector in the economy. I know it drives things on the good side, on the bad side, etc. I don't think I can go much beyond that. I think it is something we'd like to explore more. We are working with the central bank, the reserve bank, on trying to better understand the link between investment and volatility, and see how much it affects investors' decision. On the downgrade, it was also a paper done jointly with the Reserve Bank. I think we can of course discuss the sample, etc., the limitations, and I think we expressed them in the paper and can be more expressed. But so basically, the methodology consisted in trying to look at the episodes of a downgrade, which is like a threshold from above investment to below investment level, and see what has happened in other countries. There are not so many episodes, but there were quite a few. And we also control for the fact that the market has already priced in some of the impact of the downgrade. So our computations account for the fact that it has already been partially anticipated by the market. So this impact is already reflected in the level of interest rates. Then on the constraints on the fiscal situation, we can again, we don't have all the answers. I think what we are trying to look is what can be done to improve some instruments. It doesn't prejudge of the. I mean, if you have a extremely high rate of return on some of your public expenditure, you should go for it. And if you have the financing, the long-term financing that you can get, would finance it, of course you should go for it. You should not be limited by a debt level to GDP of 50% or whatever. I mean, but and this way, I mean, I we don't have all the answers. Again, it all depends, I think, on the quality of your public expenditure, and that's what. I mean, this work should be continued. On the competition between the agencies, the BRICS, just want to remind the attendants that the World Bank is also extremely competitive in terms of financing. Your BRICS, or you say not colleagues, but your BRICS, the other BRICS members are engaging much more with the World Bank in terms of financing. China is the first client of the World Bank. India is extremely also active with the World Bank. We just had a workshop last December with the National Treasury to try to understand how things could work better. I think the World Bank and South Africa have gone into some of a form of a vicious circle that because there's not so much engagement, nobody knows what the other is doing. So a lot of preconceptions and prejudgments on what would be the response of the World Bank to something, or what would be the demands of South Africans. And it's but a lot can be done, I think, to find solutions that are helpful to South Africa. From our experience, China, for instance, is borrowing a lot from the World Bank. It's maybe 2 or 3 billion a year. And they are not borrowing because they need the financing. But they use the financing to import technology, know-how, and what we call implementation support for new projects. They haven't gone through a reform of their social security system, a vocational training in lagging regions, all kind of things for which they'd like to get the experience of other countries. They use financing to bring with that all the know-how, the internal experience that has been gathered in the rest of the world. Because the first thing we would do, of course, for instance, if a country asks us to some help for, let's say, let's improve the targeting of your social security program, or let's say that they will look at what has happened in other countries, what has worked, what has not worked, and would bring the officials from other countries where that can bring some insight. So that's the point I wanted to make. On the on the technicalities and of the report, we do these reports to engage with you. So that's the point on us. We'll try to make more efforts to be more accessible. Try to find always the right balance between being technically credible, but at the same time be open, because of course we want these reports to be useful for people who are making decisions, and you are representing the people. So I'm just saying that next time we'll try to be more helpful on the very specific points you mentioned about the role of the exchange rate for imports and exports when the rand is depreciating. Imports are becoming more expensive compared with goods produced locally. So goods produced locally are becoming more competitive. It's cheaper to buy goods produced locally than imported. And it's the same on export markets. It becomes cheaper for European countries to import South African products when they buy them in rands if the rand is lower. But it's more complicated than that, because in your production process you import goods to produce a good itself, etc. So we capture that as well, but that's basically how it works. Reduce policy uncertainty, I think I tried to discuss that a bit. I must admit we don't really know what it means, and we are trying actually to disentangle that and see what investors are looking for. Why they are concerned. I understand very much the point of view of the departments, etc., who are setting their policy, who are strong with their policies, and they know what they want to do, etc. So we're trying to understand what it means. But I would not comment much more on that. On education, there's a small box in the report, but it would deserve a much, much longer discussion, because to me it's really the key of the future of South Africa. And what we are saying is that there are a few things that can be done really to improve basic education, which is a foundation of everything in South Africa. And there's something that can be done to benefit a bit more in the medium term from the demographic transition which is ongoing in South Africa. There will be less kids in the future. Compared to adults, it gives more resources to the nation to invest in education per student, but it needs also a lot of planning, because there's a lot of population movements, etc. And the third thing we are discussing, and also related to the employment tax, is the need to put the youth on the job market and get their professional experience. Something that has happened in many other countries, which you see that this employment tax incentives as like a long-term internship or professional education, so that they can put a step in the labor market and they get some professional experience. It doesn't have to be prolonged too long, but you want the youth to be exposed to what is professional life, because it is very important, and otherwise you are in a vicious circle. You don't get hired because you don't have experience, and you don't have experience because you don't get a job. So that's important. There was a question for a bit similar between the two of you on the incentives. What we are just saying is that when we look at the incentives overall, some are working, some are delivering in terms of generating additional investment, some others are not. And then it means that it's extending those incentives in those sectors where it does not deliver, it's a waste. It's a waste of fiscal resources. So if you concentrate your resources in the sectors where it works, you increase the efficiency of your overall incentive package. And then you save some money that you may want to put in the sectors where it works or put elsewhere. I don't really know. There was a question on examples of country where it works. Yeah, I think it would and I don't have the answer, but I think it's more a developed country issue. I mean, those tax incentives or investment tax incentives are, I think, much more prominent in developed countries in Europe, in Japan, maybe in the U.S. as well, and a lot of experience has to be gained there. And there is no obvious lesson why it works, why it doesn't work. This is one of the elements of an investment decision for an investment maker that may be concerned by the prospects in the markets. That's why we're saying you need to have investment opportunities in the first place. The investor needs to see an opportunity. And this is why we're insisting on the comparative advantages in those sectors that are emerging, where you have investment opportunities and you want to encourage investors to go in sectors where investment opportunities lie. Otherwise, you would push them in a corner where there's no investment opportunity. So the incentive is just the last thing to bring the investor in a sector. It should not be offsetting everything else because it won't work. It should accompany, encourage a bit more investor, but that's not the only thing. And so that's why there are many other dimensions in terms of doing business and investment decisions that matter. And we mentioned infrastructure, we mentioned education, we mentioned policy uncertainty, we mentioned concentration. I mean, the fact that high concentration means there are barriers to entry. There are many investors that may want to go into a sector but cannot because you have so much concentration in some sectors. This is to say that this is one instrument among many others. We've been discussing some of the other questions in other reports. But it's important not to discuss everything at the same time and look things one by one to have a bit more granularity and maybe certainty on what we are saying. On the currency, the floating currency, I think we should acknowledge again that the volatility is harmful. It is obviously linked to the exchange rate regime, the financialization of the economy, the commodity prices. I don't have an answer in terms of the instrument that should be implemented. But I think that's a decision that needs to take place in your arena and with the government to see what can be done to maybe address this problem. Household indebtedness, I think it is also a very important discussion. We are, and I don't have the answer to you, but I think your concerns and questions are very well placed. We are currently conducting what we call a poverty assessment, where you look at household surveys, the determinants of their consumption, their income, and debt is one important determinant of the welfare of the people, and positive and negative. So we can look, and I think it's a very good proposal to look a bit more at how all these loans are being used, what for, in which condition they are used to generate higher investment, maybe in the informal sector or in the formal sector, etc. And then you mentioned a number of things about property prices. It's another dimension which is very important. I don't have any answer on that. On insurance mechanism, on the role of the droughts and the volatility, and our borrowing is also maybe serve as a buffer at some point. We are discussing with South Africa, the National Treasury, on the review trying to improve the insurance mechanisms for farmers, what works, what doesn't work, to reduce the volatility and the risks to which they are exposed. And last was the comment on the rating agencies. I mean, Yes, there's a lot of, I'm French, there's a lot of uncertainty in my country and in my neighboring country, UK. There's a lot of uncertainty in the world. It's not something at all specific to South Africa. And rating, I cannot comment on what rating agencies are writing. This is, they write what they want and people take what they want of what they write. And the only thing, the only thing you can maybe do if you're concerned by that is try to, to convince them if you think useful to convince them that you're going in the right direction. But we're not a rating agency at all, and I can certainly understand the concern and sometimes the irritation of every country when it comes to this type of statements and matters. And, they are free to say what they want. And, you are free to take what you want from them. Thank you.
I thought you were going to say the only thing is to avoid being downgraded. I thought you were going to say that. No, that's fine. It's a comment from me.
No, we are thinking, and with all the caveats, that the downgrade would be a negative outcome for South Africa. It is not the end of the world, too. It's a symptom, in a sense, of maybe a problem that lies in the perception of the fiscal policy from investors, etc., that needs to be addressed. So, it should not be the center of your attention. The center of your attention should be the quality of your public spending, the quality of your fiscal management and economic management overall for job creation and for poverty reduction. That's the objective, no? The rating agency is certainly not an objective in itself.
Thank you so much. I am going to ask your input or your comment on this. And then the chairperson of the Portfolio Committee on Economic Development will also ask a question. Dr. Skatane?
Thank you very much, Chairperson, and we welcome the presentation from the World Bank, and we agree with what they are saying, especially on the outlook of the global economy, but we say, you know, as a country, we still need, like they say, on the move towards the direction of achieving the targets of the NDP, like they say, because that's the direction of the country. So we need to move towards that, do away with the issue of unemployment and poverty in the country. So next week, as we welcome and look at the budget, we need to make sure that the budget is towards financing the objectives on the NDP, because that's the direction of the country. So we need to make sure that we achieve the targets, because otherwise we're going to miss our own targets that we set for 2030. We might think that is too far. It's not too far. So we need to move towards financing the objectives and targets of the NDP. So I welcome the presentation, especially because they say we need to concentrate on achieving what the NDP is saying.
Mr. Ambra?
Thank you, Chairperson. I have largely been covered by my director and my colleague, Mapula. Nonetheless, again, I'd like to thank the World Bank for the presentation. It's good to see that the PBO's input and our work on industrial policy costing actually made it in, and I'm glad to see. We presented this to the Appropriations Committee last year in August, and it's been presented again. And I think this discussion is absolutely critical in a constrained fiscal environment. To talk about more efficient fiscal stimulus, particularly when it comes to industrial policy, is critical. And I'm glad that we're no longer, you know, having a should we or shouldn't we advance fiscal policy or industrial policy, but rather what can we do. And we look forward to further engagement on this topic with the bank. And next week we're presenting to a joint sitting between Standing and Select Finance and Appropriations on our pre-budget statement work. So we'd like to continue the discussion over there. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Honorable Chair.
Thank you very much. Let me join also those who appreciated the briefing. I think it was quite eye-opening, although some of the issues we already deal with as a country. I think a tone has been set already through the State of the Nation address in terms of NSFI's commitment towards full implementation of the NDP. You would also say the taste is in the implementation, of course, is there, and I think the trend goes towards that. When you talk of addressing domestic constraints, that would actually help in increasing our potential GDP growth. You spoke of constraints around competition and regulation shortcomings. I just want you to elaborate further on that. If you can just also give us examples of what you're talking to. I know our president has already indicated that we'll be coming with amendments to the competition law, but it would be interesting also to hear from your side, because I haven't read your book because I just received it, just to understand what you mean by that. And I'm asking this mainly because the competition issues also reside within the portfolio I'm overseeing. Thank you. Second one that I forgot. I just want to get your thinking around the motor industry incentives. Whether you think they contribute positively towards job opportunities, or whether you think there are any constraints even around the very same incentive as far as how we're giving it.
I take it that this will be the last question. Any appetite for more? You would want to say something
and also
now or after him? Maybe now, so that he then rounds up.
The question is linked to the work for the Davis Tax Commission. The issue of base erosion is really important, and using numbers from the global financial integrity, for instance, we see very large outflows, and if you measure that and take, say, 30% effective tax rate, the average deficit would decrease to about 0.2% from, I think, it's the period 2005 to 2013 or something. So I was wondering if the World Bank and Davis Commission were looking at the base erosion issues and how to reduce that, because I think that has a huge impact on our fiscal space and that we're not talking about that. Tell me if I'm taking too much time, Honourable Chair. I just wanted to raise the issue that Honourable Kwabasha raised about household debt, and just to quickly say that the household debt issues are very different for rich people and poor people in South Africa. Rich people
will save through institutional investors like pension funds, retirement annuities, etc., but then they'll take on a huge amount of debt on the other side to pay for houses and cars, and part of the escalation in house prices, etc., is linked to that. And so even rich households have huge amounts of debt, but it's offset by some of the savings for the retirement. Poor households, on the other hand, are getting increasing debt, but and they're not able to actually save because of poverty and inequality. I've got a lot more to say on that, and hopefully maybe that's something we can come back to in the future, but I think it's important to understand how different parts of South African society are affected differently by savings, investment, and debt. Thank you.
No, thank you very much, Chairperson. I have only one question, and it's with regards to the new developments that are taking place in Britain and in U.S. What is the thinking of the World Bank with regards to that, especially in the developing countries? Thank you.
Well, thanks again for these questions, and I'll try to answer them again in chronological order to the extent I can. First, on the issue of concentration, I think we have at least two sets of issues there. One was the issue of enforcement of existing regulations and the anti-cartel law, what we call ex-post control of concentration, and this is actually the topic of the previous update, and I think we see a lot of progress. We made a lot of suggestions on what could be done to further improve the enforcement of existing regulations. When it comes to new competition law, etc., I don't know what it entails yet, so I cannot comment on that, but what I just want to say is that when you look at the data from SARS, the micro level data that we have, and also another of other indications, there's this striking fact that something like, if I'm correct, above 50% of the value added in the country and the number of jobs created in the country are being done by the 1% top firms. So there's huge concentration. Very unusual concentration of economic and bargaining power in the hands of a very, very few firms. And it is very difficult to believe that those firms are not taking benefits of their position to generate rents and markups, which in turn really affect the rest of the economy in terms of higher input costs to their own economic processes. Consumers we have to also pay for those markups and smaller firms that cannot enter the markets. And we know too from this micro data set that smaller firms are typically more innovative and more productive. So by preventing their extension, you also inhibit innovation and productivity gains. So I don't have answers in terms of what should be done, because I think it's a huge topic. But I think to a great extent, the future of the South African economy will very much depend on how those firms behave and how much they serve the country. And they do a lot of good things, but this is a central, their behavior is a central element of any future for the South African economy, given their size and their importance in the economic fabric of the country. The second question was about the automotive specific tax incentives. As I mentioned, when we started this work, we just relied on a data set up to 2012. At that time, those incentives were not put in place because I understand they were introduced in 2013. We understand they are very generous, much more generous than across the board tax incentive for the manufacturing sector. I understand too, I made some small calculation that they basically concern about 10% of the investment that has been done in the manufacturing sector since 2012. So they would not change the overall picture in terms of the contrast between the manufacturing sector and the mining sector when it comes to the effective tax rates. But I cannot comment on the effectiveness and efficiency of those specific incentives. But we are going to look into them now, again with the Davis Commission and of course the National Treasury, and again to try to assess their effectiveness in terms of generating new investment, new jobs, and at what cost for the fiscus. That's very important. I was not sure if it's base erosion, tax evasion. This is something we are not looking at in particular, although we're trying to start to understand again also the role of the big firms and their investment decision abroad. I know it affects tax collection, but also economic activity in the country. But this is something in relation also to my first point. I think this is really something to be looked at. And I think it relates also to the negative net foreign direct investment position of the country, etc. And maybe there was the last point was about the recent development in the U.S. and in Britain when it comes to developing countries. There's still a lot of uncertainty on what will prevail, what it would mean for, in particular, I think, trade policy, migration policy, and foreign aid or financing to developing nations. But I would say that everything that prevents trade between developing countries and the larger economy of the U.S. and the U.K. will be detrimental for the developing economies. I don't think we know what will happen in Britain yet. I was in Namibia last week discussing with the SACU secretariat, and they were asking us to help them develop a tool to understand or to negotiate a new trade deal with the UK. We said maybe it was a bit premature because we don't know at all what they are going to do first with their current trade policies. But so there's a lot of uncertainty, but lower trade integration, lower migration flows will be, I don't think, will be very helpful for the developing economies. And thank you very much again for this the opportunity to engage. We are happy to come more often. I mean, if you want us to come more often, we need to bring you something to the table. We need to produce reports as well. I think this is a constraint on our side, but we are extremely happy and honored to be part of those discussions. Thank you very much.
Well, from where I am sitting, it was an interesting engagement. Just my comment before I hand over to the chairperson to close, to give us the closing remarks, is at least this report has given us hope, particularly on the issue of the foreseen modest economic recovery, and also the fact that you have advised on how this can be accelerated. So thank you very much. So can I then hand over to the chair to give us the closing remarks?
I am launched, Chair.
I'm good. We share it.
Okay, thank you very much. Let me, on behalf of the two committees, really extend our appreciation for the work done, or the work that you're doing, together with other stakeholders, which are very key to this parliament. the presentation that you've just made and also responses afterwards. Obviously, what you've given us will continue to really challenge us in terms of our thinking and possible applications for practical solutions to our challenges. We have developmental challenges, and we'll continue to seek solutions towards development challenges, because ours is South Africa, as a developing country. It's a journey towards a journey in pursuit of development, and anything that contributes towards that journey really is appreciated. Really, we appreciate what you have given us and the opportunity, the mere fact that you left everything and agreed to come and brief us as part of your work. We really appreciate that, together with Umemra Chitanga. We yearned to hear your voice, but unfortunately we couldn't. But thank you for your presence here. Let me also thank the PBO. We're hoping as a committee on economic development that you, because we're expecting you to come and also brief us on the new, we're waiting for the budget, new budget. It's not this one, because we've already done and analyzed this one at the MTBPS. From my side and my team, let's also thank the chairperson and the committee for allowing us to share this information as the Portfolio Committee on Economic Development. We really appreciate the opportunity. And as I said initially, a tone has been set already. We are on that path, on a developmental path, and we'll continue to do so. Thank you so much, members, for your attendance and your participation. Thanks.
Honorable members, our guests, the meeting stands adjourned. Thank you.